Russia's war in Ukraine is in its second month, and as of now, there's no sign of a slowdown in fighting. Our next guest says most conflicts usually don't end up this way. He says more often war is the exception, not the rule. That's because there's more upside, even in a bitter compromise, than in a long and deadly fight. That's true whether we're talking about international conflict or a local dispute among gangs. We're talking about the causes of war and what brings about peace, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. If I asked you, what are the main things that cause war, what's your answer? Does it feel to you like peace is more or less common than war? Do you think we focus too much on the causes of war instead of looking for ways to prevent it and maintain peace? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Christopher Blattman is an economist and political scientist who studies global conflict, crime, and poverty at the University of Chicago. His new book is called Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I think coming out of my early history education, Chris, sometimes history looks like a series of one war and then another war and another war. But I want to quote from your book here. You write, wars shouldn't happen, and most of the time they don't. War is the exception, not the rule. Can you talk about why that is?
Right. I mean, it's natural for our attention to be drawn to, I mean, just the horror that's going on right now. You know, just like a doctor should be paying attention to the critically ill. But we want our doctors to remember that most people are healthy. And so I want people to remember that most of us don't go to war. And you know, a good example came 2 weeks into Russia's invasion of Ukraine, when India accidentally lobbed a cruise missile at Pakistan and common sued, just as it has for decades between these two countries that are tense, you know, are tensely competing, but generally it's not violent. Another example is, you know, school children are going to learn about the invasion of Afghanistan for decades. And very few of them are going to learn about the U.S. invasion of Haiti in 1994, when Colin Powell went, confronted the dictator, said, look, if you don't hand power back to the democratically elected president, here's a video of dozens of American planes taking off full of troops and equipment. And that was 2 hours ago. They're almost here. And he capitulated immediately. And so, but these sort of quiet moments of compromise slip from our memory.
The incentive in most cases among potentially violently conflicting parties is for peace, you write. Why is that? Why do the costs of going to war ultimately usually end up being prohibitive?
Well, just look what's happening now. Just the death, the destruction, the cities turned to rubble. The sons going home in body bags from the front, the civilians killed, the treasuries that are emptying on both sides. And it's so prohibitively costly that you know, I say enemies prefer to loathe in peace. And frankly, you know, we risk forgetting that. We risk forgetting that Putin spent the last 20 years trying to co-opt the Ukraine in every other insidious way possible, save war, assassinations, dark money, propaganda, support for separatists, and so on. It really, like in so many cases, it's either not used at all, and when it's used, it's often a last resort.
In spite of this powerful disincentive to war, obviously we do have war, and you list five things, five different, I guess, categories of things that lead us into war. I want to check in with each of them. First of all, and this one seems very relevant, unchecked interests. If I'm the person who's deciding whether to go to war, and I personally am very insulated from the consequences of that war, as it seems, for example, Vladimir Putin is, that takes away some of that disincentive. How does that factor into wars?
Well, so he pays some of these costs of war. He's certainly under some risks, and it's his treasury that's emptying. But because he's insulated, he doesn't have to worry about the ordinary deprivations of his citizens or those who are getting killed. So he can afford to ignore. He also, you know, it's precisely because he's trying to preserve an autocratic regime that it's part of his incentive to invade the Ukraine, because he's trying to exterminate this democratic example on his border. There's lots of motivations for him to go in there, but one of them is the fact that here's a place that's had two democratic revolutions in 20 years, tossing out Russian-facing dictators. That's a pretty dangerous example from Putin's point of view to Russian dissidents, and he'd like to exterminate that example.
Another reason, another misconception that can lead parties into war is, and this kind of relates to what you're just saying, intangible incentives. People aren't just making cold economic calculations. What could this war cost me? What could the financial or economic benefit? How do these play into it?
Right. And I would say, you know, this idea that he's going to get turfed out and strung up and, you know, he has these visions of ending up like Gaddafi or is a very tangible worry for him. But there are all these stories that we hear that I think are true. I mean, no one really knows what's in Putin's mind. But when you hear a story that says he's seeking glory or a place in history, or maybe something larger than himself, he's seeking a return to Soviet power. He wants to counter the humiliation of the Soviet Union. You know, you hear all these stories, and all of these are these intangible incentives. There are things that he's willing to pay the cost. So it's not that he's ignoring the costs because he's not accountable for them. Rather, this is a whole bunch of things where he's saying, no, there's something that war will get me, an invasion will get me, that nothing else will, and I'm willing to pay it for this sort of intangible ideological payoff.
We're talking to Christopher Blattman, author of the new book, Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace, looking at why incentives toward peace sometimes break down, whether we're talking about international conflict or a local conflict among gangs, a local civil war. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions about why war happens, how we can prevent it. That's 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Chris, I want to step aside from those causes of war for a moment to look at a different scale. I thought this was a really interesting example. You spent time in Colombia talking in prisons to leaders of organized crime organizations. What did you learn there about what led to a very violent period to a substantially less violent period?
So, you know, I start off the book telling a story about how speaking to one of these leaders in prison, he told me about a fight that broke out in his cell block over a game of billiards that got out of hand really fast. One side pulled out their guns and fired on the other. And why they're carrying guns in prison is probably a whole other radio show. But what happened was what you would predict next is a series of vindictive killings and essentially the beginnings of a blood feud. And the city's gangs all lined up behind one side or the other, and basically the city geared for war. But as I said, you know, nobody wants a war. It's too expensive. You know, you don't, if you're drugging, you don't sell any retail drugs in a gunfight. And the big bosses in the city, you sort of lose the invisibility that's their shield. And so there's all these incentives to find a way to back down. And those gangs are unchecked, like you said, they might have their own intangible incentives. That's what revenge is. That's what vengeance is. So those two we just went through. So those are two reasons to ignore the costs. But there's still this powerful incentive towards pulling them towards peace. And if it wasn't there, what happened is these upper-level leaders, these mafia-like organizations called Razones, who are the leaders of whom we meet and have been trying to understand how they work, are more than happy to promise sanctions, maybe at the point of a gun, are more than happy to provide them a bargaining table to get rid of some of the uncertainty and the misperceptions that they have, are more than willing to uphold deals that they make and actually put a lot of pressure on them to make deals. They're a little bit like the UN Security Council of the city. They call it La Oficina, or the office. And if the gangs ever fail to see that incentive and ignore the costs and therefore start to go to war, for the last 10 years, this La Oficina has been really effective at helping them keep the peace. And so the murder rate is probably a third of what it is here in my home city of Chicago.
What lessons are there if we're looking to de-escalate a violent conflict among maybe some pretty bad actors, whether it's in a big American city or in a war-torn country facing a civil war? How can we, if we're the UN, the local government, whatever, how can we think about incentives when our first instinct might be to just say, we got to punish the bad actors?
Yeah, I mean, if it comes, starts with remembering one thing. If war is incredibly costly, if it's ruinous, every answer to why we fight is a reason that one side or the other ignores those costs. And the first two examples we went through, leaders are unchecked, intangible incentives, are reasons to ignore those costs. you flip this around, every path to peace is actually a way to get both parties to pay attention to the costs that they're ignoring, or giving them counter incentives to the things that are leading them to ignore those costs. And so when we think about sanctions, so everyone is familiar with international sanctions, and the ones that were placed as a threat were threatened to be placed on Putin if he invaded, and were not enough to deter him, but surely made him think twice and made many other dictators think twice. That's a great example of countering unchecked leaders' intangible incentives. The same tools get used to counter cartels. So the Colombian government, the Mexican government go to the drug cartels and they say, you want our military and our police to put you away to sort of dedicate our resources to your neighborhood? Well, let the bodies keep dropping. And Colombia has been very effective at this. And it's one of the reasons that I think it's been as peaceful as it has the last 10 or 20 years. U.S. cities have a program called Focus Deterrence. It's exactly the same thing. It's targeted sanctions. It's saying, going to the gangs and saying, if violence appears in your neighborhood, we're going to come down on you. So stop it. And that also seems to be fairly effective. So at every level, countering these incentives, compelling unchecked leaders to internalize some of these costs seems to be reasonably, it's not a mass solution, but it helps.
We're talking to Chris Blattman, economist and political scientist who studies global conflict at the University of Chicago. We're talking to him about his new book. It's called Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see as the things that drive war, ongoing violent conflict, locally or internationally? What are the things that are important to you to keep peace? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to University of Chicago economist Christopher Blattman about his new book, Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about why war breaks out, why peace more commonly persists, even during tough conflicts. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Hello. The guy David Graeber, who was an anthropologist or an archaeologist, I forget which, wrote a book called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. And in that book, he describes the process of money creation on the part of the state or the imperialist. In that process, the claim made by the imperialist is that they get to create what the people must use for money in order that they pay their taxes. So if we continue to believe that at the very top, the creation of money is something that is done by authoritarian dictate, and then we have to pay our taxes in that form, then the populace has to do whatever it is that the imperialist declares. And if the imperialist wants to go to war, in order for you to get your taxes paid, you have to pay in money, which the imperialist can create out of thin air.
Mark, thanks for the call. That gets, Chris, I think, to your point, ultimately, of unchecked interest. Does the person at the top, who's, if, among other things, minting the money, get to make these decisions regardless of the meaning for the populace?
Yeah, and you know what else is interesting to me is I think imperialism, the way he's just described it, which I think is just right, is actually an example of the incentives for peace. I mean, the sad fact is most of human history, most human societies, a small elites dominated the masses, and there were some popular revolts, but for the most part, people were subjugated. So that was not violent. So there's nothing that says peace has to be equal. Peace is just the fact that the weak often don't have the incentives to rise up against the strong. And that's actually the unfortunate consequence in some ways of these powerful incentives and of the costs of war. And only occasionally do you get a colonized people like the Ukrainians who say, no way, we're not going to stand for this. We're not going to take this raw deal on offer, and we're going to fight, even though it's ruinous, we're going to fight out of an intangible incentive for this desire for liberty, for rightness. And so I think imperialism is a great example of these sort of sad, it's the sad implication of the incentives towards peace.
Mark, thanks for the call. Go to Marcus now in Madison. Marcus, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Professor Glavin, I'm a little surprised it hasn't come up yet, but when it comes to this topic, the U.S. is the final expert. Since 1776, the U.S. has been at war 93% of the time, and there are only 21 total years where we weren't at war. There's never been a U.S. president that was a peacetime president. And the U.S. only went 5 consecutive years without a war during the isolationist period of the Depression. So 222 out of 239 years, we have been at war.
Marcus, thanks for the call. It'll, of course, depend, I think, on your definition of war and justifications for individual moments. But that said, Marcus's point, Chris, that the U.S. has spent a goodly amount of time at war. Have we learned lessons?
Right. I mean, listen, I didn't write a book called Why We Don't Fight, you know, because he's right. Like, there is an awful lot of war. There's certainly too much. And the United States has been at war far more than I would like it to be. So I'm sympathetic to this. I guess my point, if I want people to remember one thing, it's to actually, if we want to put this in perspective and we want to understand, we could talk about specific wars, because I think every one that the U.S. has been involved in is different. I think it's all sort of comes down to this one thing, that war is costly, and every answer to why America has fought is it's had some reason, strategic or otherwise, to ignore those costs. And so if we want to understand war, it's just useful to start with that counter incentive and then try to understand, you know, why we ignore it.
Chris Plattman is with us, author of the new book, Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. You look at things that help prevent war or solve war. One of the solutions is an interdependence among people in a community, in a society, or with their international neighbors. One concern here in the U.S. is that with increased polarization, we're in less contact. We're in maybe less interdependence with one another. Do you worry that that could lead to internal violence here in the United States?
So I think the risk is tiny, but it's not zero, and that should be terrifying. And so I think we have to take it very seriously. I agree, like a society that is not polarized, that's where we're socially and economically intermingled. The more socially and economically intermingled we are, the more we have empathy for the other side, the less likely we are to go to war. Because not only is war costly to me, war's costly to you. And I care a little bit about you at least. And that's going to make war more costly in my vision. But, you know, this basic incentive, this idea that like war is ruinous, therefore we have incentives not to do it, doesn't actually even require me to care about you. The basic assumption is the basic principle at work here is just the costs to me are enough that I should strive to avoid it. Now, so that is why, and I think we've seen that. I think even in a polarized state, I think our political parties, I think the vast majority of Americans sort of went up to the point of violence, this sort of semi-organized, semi-expressive event that happened on January 6th, and they said, we don't want to go any further. All right, and we have a whole set of institutions and law enforcement, I think, that have actually responded reasonably effectively since then. And so we haven't seen a repeat. And that makes me quite hopeful about the future.
You share a quote from former President Ronald Reagan in the book, "A peace is not the absence of conflict. It is the ability to handle conflict by peaceful means." And that, in some ways, is really encouraging. We're not expecting the Colombian gang members to, you know, give each other hugs and buy each other coffee. But they have an incentive, if they can recognize it, to not have their people shooting each other.
Right. And you know, there's all of these leaders have reminded us this throughout history. Winston Churchill said it's better to jaw-jaw than war-war. Mao told us that war is politics with bloodshed. And von Clausewitz told us that war is just politics by other means. They're all telling us the exact same thing, that we have two ways to sort of get something from our adversary. We can do it violently, or we can do it nonviolently. And the fact is that these aren't equal means. One is incredibly costly. And so at all times, we at least try and often succeed in seeking the other path. And it's important. It's the idea, again, I bring it back to this idea that we should focus on the critically ill, right? We have to, our attention must be seized by what's happening now in a place like Ukraine, but we're not going to design the right, like a doctor who would design the wrong treatments if he couldn't, if he was diagnosing everyone as critically ill, right? We're not going to get the right interventions and programs if we don't really understand these sort of normal incentives towards peace.
In our educational process, do you think we should have more focus on the times of peace, on the conflicts that didn't escalate into war and why that happened?
You know, I think we often do, whenever we talk about periods of growth and democracy and development, these are implicitly times of actual peace. So I think we could just draw it out better. What I'd also like to see enter our curriculum are some of these more basic actual skills of conflict resolution. I mean, it does enter our curriculum, especially for young kids. But I mean, I think there are a lot of very basic skills that can enable us in our daily lives, in our organizations, in our government to actually avoid some of these five roots of war, and that would actually, you know, make this a slightly more stable life, stable society for us all.
Chris, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Christopher Blattman. He studies global conflict, crime, and poverty at the University of Chicago. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace.